Famous for their iconic Humboldt fog, inspired by the misty Humboldt County coastline, Cypress Grove has been a cornerstone of American cheese for over 40 years. Their range of fresh, soft-ripened, and aged goat cheeses promises an unforgettable experience. Proudly crafted in Arcata, California, where the redwoods meet the Pacific Ocean, Cypress Grove cheeses are available nationwide at specialty retailers. Discover their cheeses, serving tips, and even order online at cypressgrovecheese.com. Perfect for any occasion or as a gift. There's nothing like that Humboldt fog feeling.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. Our summer holidays have been put on hold because of COVID-19, so in tonight's show, we're going to let our imagination soar as we head to Granada in Spain and bring you the history of the Alhambra. A pearl set in emeralds, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site that has been called the most magnificent example of a medieval Islamic palace city in Western Europe. We'd love you to join our discussion tonight. Just send us a text to 53106. Text costs 30 cents, or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we investigated the largest execution of British soldiers on the Western Front in the First World War and find out about sport and leisure in the Irish countryside 100 years ago, and lots more besides in our June book show. And 2 weeks ago, we looked at the life and music of the composer Dvorak. So if you want to listen back to any of these shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. In tonight's show, we're letting our imaginations travel to Granada in Spain as we discuss the history of the Alhambra. The historian Michael Barry has described vividly the wonderful location, situated on a commanding hill above Granada with the snow-capped Sierra Nevada as a backdrop. It is one of Spain's great monuments, a palace complex that contains outstanding examples of Islamic architecture. In tonight's show, we'll explore the rise of Islam in Iberia and how the Alhambra was constructed and what it represents, the evolution of Granada, and what happened after the conquest of 1492 when Muslim rule in the Iberian Peninsula came to an end. And to help me do all this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Glare Anderson lectures in Islamic art and the history of art at the University of Edinburgh and is an expert on Islamic arts and architecture. And her books include The Islamic Villa in Early Medieval Iberia, and she's the editor of Revisiting Al-Andalus, Perspectives on the Material Culture of Islamic Iberia and Beyond. Dr. Olga Bush is a visiting professor of art history and visual culture at Bard College in New York, and her books include Reframing the Alhambra, Architecture, Poetry, Textiles, and Court Ceremonial. Michael Barry is an author and historian, and his books include The Alhambra Revealed, The Remarkable Story of the Kingdom of Granada, and Homage to Al-Andalus. Donald McGilvray is a leading expert on the conquest of Granada and is the author of Granada, The Seizure of the Sultanate. Well, you're all very welcome, and later in the show I'll be talking to Professor Barbara Beloix-Gallardo, who lectures in the Department of Semitic Studies at the University of Granada and whose books include The Sultanas of the Alhambra. Well, as I say, you are all very welcome, and Olga, I might begin with you, and a question about the palace and the gardens. What is it about them that have captured the public imagination for at least two centuries?
Well, thank you so much, Patrick, for having me on your program. Alhambra is actually a fortified palatial city. It's not just the palace that is comprised of a fortress for an army garrison, the royal medina or city, then extended eastward, comprising buildings for the court administration, palaces with courtyards, pools and gardens, a congregational mosque, oratories, baths, a royal cemetery, and at the east end of the hilltop, the industrial zone that encompassed the royal workshops for the production of luxury goods for the consumption of the court. And as Michael Barry already, you quoted him, it extends on the top of the escarpment of the Sabica Hill and sort of looming over the city of Granada below and against the backdrop of the Sierra Nevada mountains. It is perhaps the best preserved medieval Muslim palatial city anywhere. And the presence of its vibrant colors in the decoration of the Alhambra interiors, whether it is stucco, glass, ceramic tile mosaics, or wood, kind of added the exoticism to its architecture in the European imagination of the late 18th and 19th centuries, since it was very much in contrast to Greek, Roman, and medieval European buildings, which at the time were understood as completely devoid of color. So in contrast to medieval European architecture, Alhambra's palace is set amidst a luscious cultivated landscape, and especially the architectural decoration were perceived as exotic and quote-unquote sensual when the Alhambra was discovered, as if it were, in Europe's backyard in the late 18th century. And many French and English writers and artists wrote about it, drew it already as early as 1770s, and that can kind of contributed to the to capturing the imagination of Europeans and everywhere around the world. So,
no, absolutely beautiful description there. Claire, Olga really captures the colour, the beauty, the significance of this fortress city. What was it like when you first visited, and what does it mean as a space for you?
Right. Well, I first visited the Alhambra in 2001 as a doctoral student visiting Spain for the first time. And I was with my mother and my two-year-old son, and we were lucky enough to visit the Alhambra at night and on a moonlit night that was incredibly warm and balmy and beautiful. And we were fortunate enough to be there when there were actually very few people, which is not something that happens often at the Alhambra. And at a certain point, I remember actually the three of us were alone in the court of the Myrtles. And I remember gazing up at the full moon that was, you know, shining down on the rippling surfaces of the water channels and the pool and feeling the breeze, you know, having the scent of myrtles in the air and the sound of the water. And I've been to the Alhambra many, many other times since then, but that was without a doubt an architectural experience that I would describe as transcendent. It was certainly beyond the ordinary and the everyday. So the Alhambra is a monument that's imposing, it's monumental, but at the same time, it's also very intimate and human. And playful, the play of water and stone and solid and liquid surface of color and negative space. And it's very cerebral as well. So, you know, this is a building that's erudite and sophisticated, highly intellectual, but also fully engaging with all the senses. So it's an incredibly powerful building, I think, that speaks to people when they see it.
Yeah, some of our longtime listeners are agreeing with you. Jay Vivian from Ranala saying that it's talking about the time that Jay Vivian went on an unguided visit of the Alhambra at night, and in the moonlight, the palace is straight out of Arabian Nights, not to be missed. And Bracken and Cork talking about the buildings, the plants, the trees are so interesting, but had the problem of overcrowding because, of course, there always is such a demand. Donald, what about your own experiences? Because I think you started researching the history of Granada in the early 1970s when you lived there, and you've done so much to discuss the history of the city and then the history of this remarkable place.
That is so. I started out in Granada to really look at subjects that hadn't been discussed while I was in university in Britain. We heard a lot about the French Revolution, and as far as Spain is concerned, the Peninsular War, and of course the Armada, but very little more about Spanish history at that time. And I resolved to find out some more about it. And while I was at university, I went down there for the first time. And the thing that struck me very strongly was, here is this beautiful, magnificent palace. And it was had been the hub of a sultanate, the last bastion of Islamic rule in Spain. And the fact that that last bastion, in fact, survived with Christian and Muslim enemies all around it for 2.5 centuries was remarkable. And therefore, I thought, when I later have time, I would like to go and do some serious research, which I did in the 70s, as you said.
And might bring Michael in on this, because Michael, a word that Claire used, transcendental, to describe what the Alhambra is like, and you definitely have that sense from going through your book, because it's more than a history book, it's also a guidebook. It's so beautifully illustrated that the colours come through, the art, the architecture. You can understand why it's a World Heritage Site. You can understand why it's inspired poets and writers and filmmakers, because it is such an extraordinary place. And is that what inspired you to research and write about it?
It is indeed. It is transcendental. The word you use is exactly right. And when I got down to researching the book, and as you have indicated, I take photographs of my subjects as well. So I was very privileged by the patronato, the Alhambra, to be allowed in the morning, early in the morning, before the tourists came. And I wandered around the Alhambra, just myself and the cleaners, and they took my photographs. And that was an extraordinary experience, too, to have the Alhambra, in effect, more or less to oneself for a half an hour. Yes, it is a wonderful place. And we are very lucky that the Alhambra is in good hands, and it is available to the public. All you have to do, post-COVID, is to make a booking, and you too can go through the Alhambra, and of course the Generalife, the palace gardens nearby as well.
And Claire, what's fascinating about it is that by studying it, we learn about Islamic, medieval Islamic political society. We learn about the lives of people. We learn about the architecture. In a way, it gives us an insight into a much wider world.
Yes, very much so. I mean, the Alhambra is, as Olga has said, it's, you know, the best preserved medieval Islamic palace city that we have. And it's quite special because it shows us it's at the end of a much longer trajectory of, wonderful palace cities and also wonderful gardens and estates that were very much central to the societies of medieval Islamic Spain, the Iberian Peninsula, but also medieval Islamic societies elsewhere. So the Alhambra does a lot as a surviving monument. It tells us about earlier traditions that connect, the medieval Islamic palace traditions to those of antiquity, of ancient Rome, but also early modern Europe. So if we think about, the villas of the Italian Renaissance, the Alhambra is sort of a missing link that brings those two things together in the medieval period. And it certainly has a lot to tell us about the role of these kinds of spaces in political life. So we often, if we're thinking about Islamic societies and monuments, we might think about mosques and the importance of Islam in political political life and so forth. And certainly those monuments are much more visible because they have survived in a way that palaces and gardens simply haven't. And yet, as the Alhambra shows us, those spaces, those residential spaces, secular spaces, domestic spaces, and so forth, city spaces, were absolutely central to medieval Islamic societies.
So, Donald, can we talk about the history then of Islamic rule in Spain, and in particular then the Nasrid dynasty and their contribution to medieval Granada and the Iberian Peninsula?
Yes, that's a very big subject, but I will just do perhaps a slight comparison between Granada and the previous regimes that had ruled in Hispanic Spain. First of all, obviously the ones that come to light immediately are the Umayyad regime in Cordoba. That regime lasted as a caliphate for 3.5 centuries. And it was followed, therefore, that regime had been founded by a combination of Arab and Berber troops who had come over originally and conquered the whole of Spain and part of France, and then had been gradually forced back in the Reconquista. Their regimes were the initial ones, Umayyad, were based largely on the Umayyad regime in Damascus, whereas the later ones between them and the Nasrids, Almoravids and the Almohads were essentially Berber rulers and Berber traditions. And so Granada came after that, and with in its population a large mixture of Muslims who were both of Arab origin, some from going back to the original settlements, their families, and Berber origins, and then more recently the people from northern Morocco and the Marinid regime that was to rule during the last era of Granada. So, and Granada did differ in some ways from Cordoba, for instance, is in that Cordoba had been originally a Roman settlement and a Roman city, and the Islamic part was built around that, whereas in Granada, it had been a much more recent settlement, and it was really created with its fortress, its medina, and then the outer suburbs in the way that Muslim cities had been created in the Middle East. So that gives perhaps a little contrast without going into the personalities involved at this stage.
No, exactly. And Olga, it's fascinating. Your work on reframing the Alhambra shows that when they were designing it, some of the work was so exacting and so complicated that it took until the invention of fractal geometry to properly explain it, and that the design principles were incredibly complex.
Yes, it is true. One of the kind of great limitations of researching the Alhambra and writing about the architecture of the Alhambra is that there are very, very few historical sources. So it's not like for another Islamic dynasty, let's say, for the Ottomans, where at least there are some manuals survived, which were used by architects and craftsmen to explain some of the technologies and techniques in the initial design. We really don't know anything about the Nasrid craftsmen's technologies and practices, and the only evidence that we have is literally the architecture in front of our eyes. And My research for that particular aspect of the Alhambra was really largely based on the work of conservators who have been for the past 30 years examining every single material and trying to figure out what were the chemical compositions and natural resources, minerals, and so on for the production of polychromy, for instance, of different colors, and how all the carved stucco was actually either carved and molded, and how it was attached to the walls. And I think that one of the crucial pieces about the design of the Alhambra is a treatise on optics that was composed in the 10th century by a Baghdadi mathematician and optician, Ibn al-Haytham. And reading that source kind of very carefully allowed previous scholars, and then I kind of continued as well, to think of the geometry that went into the design of the Alhambra. And we do know that geometry played a crucial role in building the elevation, meaning how to erect a wall from the ground to the rooftop, and where to put doorways and windows and arches in relationship to the width and the height of the wall. And the design of the decoration, as I see it, was actually governed exactly by the same system of proportions, where each panel and each band of the design was in correspondence and in proportional harmony to other parts of the decoration and of the elevation. And the schemes of repetitions and differences in scale played in it as well.
And Michael, is it that the concept is that when you have an early fortress that then becomes this palace and has so many beautiful objects and elements to it, that kind of creates the unique aesthetic then, because it has this combination of all of these different things?
That's true. Ibn al Amr, who was the founder of the Nasrid dynasty, Muhammad I, as he became known, he did start off in a very practical way. He concentrated on building the Al-Kazaba, which is the fortress, first, and only then did he get down to building the palaces. And as I think a previous speaker has indicated, the palaces consisted of both public rooms to meet the public or embassies, and then administrative rooms, and then places for the kings, the emir's family. And even from the early days, they built this exquisite palace, a thing of beauty. An interesting thing, in contrast to the other speaker who mentioned the buildings in Cordoba under the Umayyads, the caliph there built a wonderful palace city too, Madinat al-Zahara, which is still, you can still see it, it's about 8 kilometers outside of Cordoba. His palace city was full of luxury items, decorations, marble from all over the known world. He spent a huge amount of money on it. That's because Al-Andalus then was the whole, or practically the whole, Iberian Peninsula with a huge amount of wealth. Now, the Kingdom of Granada was relatively small. It's about 2/3 of the size of present Andalusia. It wasn't that rich and affluent. So the materials they used in constructing the palaces there were relatively cheap. There was stucco, there was wood, and there were tiles. But what they really did have was imagination and skill, and they managed to achieve such a wonderful combination of lightness and exquisite architecture, as you can see in the Alhambra.
Wonderful. Okay, well, we're going to take a very quick break now, but when I come back, I'll be talking to Professor Barbara Beloix-Gallardo about the sultans and the sultanas of the Alhambra.
Talking History. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we discuss the history of the Alhambra. And I'm delighted to welcome to the show Professor Barbara Baloix-Gallardo, who lectures in the Department of Semitic Studies at the University of Granada. Her books include The Sultanas of the Alhambra, The Great Unknown of the Nazarid Kingdom of Granada, and Ibn al-Akmar, Life and Reign of the First Sultan of Granada. Barbara, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Hello, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure is all ours and the listeners on News Talk tonight. Can I begin with a general question about the Sultans of Granada? How sophisticated were they and how dominant was their rule between, say, the 13th and the 15th centuries?
Well, as you know, the Nazi Kingdom of Granada was founded in the 13th century after the fall of the after the military and political crisis of the Almohad dynasty in Al-Andalus. So even the Andalusian people thought that Al-Andalus was about to vanish. And it was thanks to the first Nasrid Emir, Muhammad ibn Yusuf ibn Nasr, that Al-Andalus was able to survive the crisis of the Almohad. So, and also the constant military attacks perpetrated by the King of Castile, Ferdinand III. So the Nazi Kingdom meant the last phase in the history of Al-Andalus and also the improbable perseverance of Al-Andalus. But we shouldn't forget that it constituted a very small kingdom cornered in the southeast of the peninsula and surrounded of very strong Christian kingdoms, such as the Kingdom of Castile and the Kingdom of Aragon. So, considering the limitations of the Nazi Kingdom of Granada, it's easy to understand that its sultans had a relative importance, since on one hand they succeeded in creating and maintaining an emirate for almost three centuries, in very difficult circumstances, but on the other, the relevance of the Nasrid emirs can't be compared to that of the Umayyad sovereigns of Cordoba, who were responsible for the splendor of Al-Andalus and were descendants of the Umayyads of Damascus. So, yes, it's pretty much, more or less.
Very good. And it's fascinating to see what you can learn about this, the role of women and the place of women in the Kingdom of Granada by studying the Alhambra Palace complex.
Yes, of course, women were present in the Alhambra and visiting and studying the Alhambra in feminine is very interesting. As an Islamic castle, the Alhambra was both integrated and surrounded by a complex of palaces wide enough to host numerous members of the Nasrid family, including women. And as we know, the social separation between men and women in the medieval Islamic societies had a direct reflect in the way of conceiving Islamic architecture. So the Alhambra is a good example of that. We can find in its palaces several areas clearly defined for both political male uses and other uses referred to women. And like, for example, the upper rooms of the Palace of Comares, the so-called El Serrallo, or of the Palace of the Lions, in particular, those of the Hall of the Two Sisters and the Hall of the Abencerrajes, including the Patio of the Harem, that were considered the Dar al-Nisa in Arabic, the House of Women. Also the royal baths. The royal baths were an interesting place frequented by women in specific times of the day or days of the week. So of all the Nasrid family, not only dynasty but family, extended family, in the Nasrid family, we can find many women from the 13th century until the 15th century who played a very important roles in both the politics, in the economy, and also the diplomacy developed by the kingdom.
And you've done extensive research on one prominent Nazarid princess, Fatima bint al-Akmar, and she played a central role in government and seems to have been hugely influential.
Yes, she was called the central pearl of the necklace of the dynasty. This is the expression that one Arabic text, the expression with which an Arabic text describes her. She was an important woman. She was descendant of Emir Muhammad II, who was his father. And she was also the daughter of Muhammad III and Nasr, who were also emirs. And so she was surrounded by emirs and could learn from their political experience. And she transmitted all that to her son, Ismail I. So after the death of her two brothers, her brother didn't have any descendants. So she was the only way for the dynasty to continue. So the emir who succeeded Sultan Nasr was Fatima's son, Ismail I. But both medieval and modern historiography interpreted this like a change in a big change in the legitimate lineage of the dynasty. So historiography interprets that Ismail I inaugurated his own dynasty, since he wasn't a direct descendant of Muhammad II and Muhammad III and Nasser. However, if we consider the power that Fatima had in on that respect, we can also interpret that Ismail I was descendant of the legitimate family dynastical branch, since he inherited the power from his mother, not from his father. So on that respect, Fatima would be an important link in the transmission of her son's right to rule. And then after Ismail I, Fatima continued exerting very important roles in the court of the Alhambra, since her two grandsons, first of all, Muhammad IV, and after his death, Yusuf I, were proclaimed emirs when they were underage. So she was responsible for the rule of these two emirs. The deep influence that he left in the politics of the Alhambra was clearly recognized when this woman sultan, Sultana, died in the 14th century, in times of Yusuf I, since one of the most important secretaries and vizier of the Nazarid court, Ibn al-Khatib, devoted to her an important poem in which he expressed the pain of the Alhambra after her loss, and saying things like, for example, woman Sultan Fatima was unique, surpassing the women of her time as the Knight of Destiny exceeds all other knights.
And finally, Barbara, a question about female slaves in this period. Do we know what religion they were? Were there Christian as well as Muslim slaves? And how difficult was their lives?
Well, the women slaves who were part of the harem of the Alhambra were generally brought to the Alhambra court by two main different ways. As captives, taken in war expeditions and being part of the booty, and also bought in slave markets. So in both cases, these women were Christian, and they belonged to the peninsular kingdoms of Castile and Aragon. So once they reached the Alhambra, they were obliged to convert to Islam and adopt the Arabic language and the Arabic culture. So they Arabized and Islamized. And they also received new names that made reference to the pleasure and beauty of nature that they represented, such as sun, shams in Arabic, or moon, hamar, or flower of gardens, zahra riyad, or gazelle, rim. So to achieve, considering that the Nazrid harem, the same that happened in other dynasties, was made up of both legitimate wives, as what, and the concubines, Ummahat al-Awlad, the first category of women were considered was considered free since they were born, while the others, the slaves, were not considered free. So it was through maternity that the concubines reached liberty, and also the same juridical rights that the free women had. So that's why history of the Nazrid was so complex, and also the everyday life of the harem, because all these women gave birth sons to the different emirs. So each of them wanted their firstborn sons to be the heir of the sultan.
Okay, well, fascinating stuff, Barbara, and thank you so much for joining us tonight. You've really brought the life of the period to our listeners with such brilliance there. Professor Barbara Baloix-Gallardo of the University of Granada, thank you so much. We'll be back with more on the history of the Alhambra right after this break.
This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we take you on a journey of discovery to Spain as we discuss the history of the Alhambra. Before the break, we talked to Professor Barbara Baloix-Gallardo and now our full panel, Dr. Claire Anderson, Dr. Olga Bush, Michael Barry and Donald McGilvray. Claire, can I ask you about how multicultural the Alhambra was? Is there a sense that you had a coming together of different backgrounds and different religions?
Well, certainly, if we think about the Alhambra and Nazrid Granada as being representative of how multicultural the medieval Iberian Peninsula was, the answer would be it was very multicultural. Of course, today we usually, think about medieval Iberia for its multi-confessional character, right? The three monotheistic faith communities of Christians, Jews, and Muslims that lived there. But even beyond being a multi-confessional society, Islamic Iberia was a diverse, pluralistic society. Certainly it was after the conquest of the Iberian Peninsula in 711, when I think as Donald mentioned earlier, Arabs from Syria, but other lands further east, like Egypt and Yemen and so forth, arrived in the peninsula. Berbers, of course, from North Africa, the intermarriage that Barbara mentioned, or the presence of women from other areas of northern Iberian Peninsula. We get the creation of new social groups and ethnic categories, so indigenous converts to Islam. We have Arabized Christians who, along with Jews, became Arabic speakers and who participated in the culture and economy and life of Al-Andalus as well. So it's a very, very diverse society. And of course, the Iberian Peninsula had also been so in antiquity and late antiquity as well. If you think about the Phoenicians, the Greeks, the Carthaginian trading colonies, the Basques and Romans, and then in late antiquity, the Byzantines, the Visigoths, and the Suevi. So in that sense, the Iberian Peninsula has always been quite a diverse, multicultural place, and certainly the Alhambra represents that.
Donald, can I ask you about the capture of Granada then in 1492, and I suppose the reconquest of Granada? What impact did that have?
That had there was several impacts. I thought about that. First of all, it was very rapid by the standards of the time. The whole conquest and the frontiers had remained more or less the same for 2.5 centuries, but the Sultanate was finally conquered in a period of 10 years. The reason for that was that Ferdinand and Isabel had a weapon which was greatly superior to anything that previously existed for the job, which was heavy artillery, which they managed to bring through the mountains with great difficulty, but very effectively. So a lot of the cities fell over that period through a combination of siege, first of all, artillery bombardments, and then assault through the holes in the walls. Now, when it came to Granada, at the final part, there was an absolutely formidable city with walls that were much stronger, and its fortress and palace, of course, the Alhambra, was considered to be, even by the Castilians who actually came into Granada and were negotiating a peace treaty, they had already warned their king and queen that the use of artillery here would not be effective, and that the city and its position under the Sierra Nevada would be very difficult to besiege. And so the decision was made not to fire on the city, but to negotiate with the last Sultan, Boabdil. And this they did over a period of about 2 years. When the final surrender came and the terms had been agreed, then the Castilians occupied the Alhambra, and it was left entirely intact. And indeed, when their government took over immediately afterwards, they governed from the Alhambra. So it still remained the hub of the area, even under Castilian rule.
And Michael, it's very interesting to look at what happened then afterwards, because during the reign of Charles V, you see some changes to the layout and design, I think.
Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire, if I remember, and Charles I of Spain. He arrived in Spain in, 1517, from Flanders. He couldn't speak Spanish. He was the grandson of the Reyes Católicos, that's Ferdinand and Isabel. So he arrives in the Alhambra in, I think it was 1526, and he made some alterations to living quarters and set up, he was living there, but he wanted it to be the center of his Holy Roman Empire. And so he set about constructing a palace suitable for that. And so that's how the palace of Charles V began. He made some demolitions of some of the Islamic the buildings there. And he appointed the architect Pedro Machuca to design this, design it in the classical style, in the Roman style, again befitting his status as Holy Roman Emperor. It was financed in part by a tax which they imposed on the poor Moriscos, that's the Muslims of Granada, who had been forcibly baptized as Christians and were being, quite frankly, abused by their new rulers.
Very good. Sorry, Michael, I'm afraid we're almost being beaten by time. So I want to go to Olga for a question about, a more broad question about the role, I suppose, of the Alhambra in Spanish national identity, and I suppose also its significance for Muslims throughout the world.
I think it's a very kind of important question. Let me say that the Alhambra is kind of was brought to the attention of the Spaniards, especially of the scholarly community in mid-19th century. And at the time of the European nation building, and the question of what architectural style should be Spanish style, what is essentially a Spanish style, was greatly debated. And of course, it was not Romanesque and it was not Gothic. And with the 800 years of Muslim domination in the Iberian Peninsula, the debate among politicians, historians, architectural historians, architects, was very, very vibrant. So in about Spanish cultural heritage and national identity as a formulation in specific terms, visible terms of the architectural style that would reflect that identity in a very particular and unique way. And this phenomenon continued in Spain up through the 1930s. And we know that many buildings that were constructed in that period from mid-19th century through 1930s, and there were, you know, bourgeois villas like in the rest of Europe and king's palaces or of smoking rooms or billiard rooms, theaters and banks, they were all constructed in what became known as Orientalist style, sort of imitating the architectural styles of medieval Iberia, in some cases, Mudéjar style, something that also came in Toledo, but came from a specific style there, but a majority of them were kind of Alhambresque style. And as many historians already in the 19th century were kind of much more, had a sense of an inclusive history, of a broader perspective on history, as in one historian said in his writing, that all Spaniards, actually, he said, we are all Muslims.
Perfect. And Olga, I'm afraid I do have to stop there. I'm afraid time has beaten us. But I think I owe a huge debt to my panelists because they have allowed our imaginations to travel to a place that unfortunately for the present we are unable to go. But sometime near in the future, we will visit the Alhambra. My thanks to Dr. Claire Anderson, Dr. Olga Bush, Michael Barry, Donald McGilvray and Professor Barbara Beloix Gallardo. We've been talking history. Next